We're going to do another dialogue from Herb Brokering's book, Worlds of Youth. And Wayne will start us off.
I see you're looking at the picture.
I'm cutting it out.
Do you know what you're doing?
Sure, I'm cutting it out.
I mean, what you're really doing? What'll the people think?
People like who?
People like anybody.
Let's start with you. What do you think?
I think it's a controversial picture.
I think it's a dirty picture. A real dirty picture.
Depends on how you look at it.
It's one of the dirtiest pictures I ever saw.
And you're saving it?
I'm displaying it. I'm displaying it in front of my best friends. This controversial, dirty, filthy picture.
Like how?
I'm mounting it and presenting it to the council.
The student council?
No, the church council.
That dirty picture?
That dirty picture. To the men and women of this congregation, and then to the whole congregation.
What for?
For Lent. For the chancel. For Lent.
You're kidding.
We won't take it down. When they see it, no one will take it down. No one.
That dirty picture will hang out there in front of the people, the women and children, and the youth? What's the matter with you? Are you some kind of pervert, some kind of maniac?
No one will take it down. They will look at it for weeks and weeks. While they sit and sing and stand to pray, they'll see it even while he preaches.
You've got your nerve.
Everyone's got to have his nerve. The nerve it took to look at the two of them and him hanging there naked between them. It's a dirty shame. It's a dirty, rotten picture. That's what we're talking about in these sections of the Gospel of Mark. I've been trying to say all week long that the message of Mark is at least as much in the structure of the gospel, in the very framework of the gospel, as in the words that get said. Mark is a very careful craftsman. He has put this gospel together in a very careful way so that the very structure of it speaks to us. And we notice this especially as we look at the key central section. That's the one we're in right now. If you're looking on the right-hand side of your sheet, you'll see the days of the week, and Saturday is the middle of the central section, the middle of Roman numeral 2. And you notice that this section has its own introductory story and its own concluding story. We did the introductory story yesterday. We'll do the concluding story on Monday. But the introduction and the conclusion are both about healing a blind man. And the point of this is that the disciples at the end of the first section simply didn't understand. And it even talks of their hearts being hardened, of the point not getting through to them. What point? The point about what kind of a redemption God is fashioning, what kind of a deliverance is going to take place. In short, what God's anointed one is going to look like, what he's going to be doing, what he's going to be up to. That's what wasn't penetrating. And I picked up a passage from Isaiah yesterday, one from Isaiah 6 that talks about God actually doing the hardening of the hearts, God making the hearts of this people fat and heavy so that they see but do not really see, so that they hear but do not really hear, so that they just don't understand. And then later on, in another section of Isaiah, in the 43rd chapter, around the suffering servant songs, Isaiah talks about the blind who will in fact see and the deaf who will in fact hear. Now Mark contrasts the misunderstanding of the disciples with their fat and hard hearts with this blind man who, when Jesus asks him, "What do you see?" he says, "I see men, but they look like trees walking around." That is, he can see dimly, and then all of a sudden Jesus says, "How do you look now?" And he says, "I see clearly." That's at the very beginning of this central section where Jesus is now laying it out clearly for the disciples. In verse 32 of the 8th chapter, 31 begins, he began to teach them that the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders and the chief priests and the scribes and be killed and after 3 days rise again. And he said this plainly. And now in each of these three predictions of the Passion, we have the same structure. Jesus tells them what's going to happen. One or another of the disciples rejects this as a picture. Jesus rebukes those who reject it and then goes on to teach the disciples something about not only his suffering, but theirs. The theme of Mark's gospel is Jesus and his disciples are redemptive in the same way in the world. We are let in on his way of being redemptive in the world. So after he rebukes Peter in the first prediction, he goes on to say, if anyone would come after me, let him deny himself and take up the cross and follow me. For whoever would save his life will lose it, and whoever loses his life for my sake and the gospel's will save it. Now Jesus does the same thing in this second prediction of the Passion. So let's take a look at that in Mark 9, chapter 2, Mark chapter 9, verses 2 to 37. This episode, too, has three incidents that are connected with it. Possibly four. One is the Transfiguration narrative. The second one is the disciples questioning about Elijah, and then the incident of the epileptic boy, and then at the end again we have the suffering Messiah incident. Let's take a look at this. After 6 days, Jesus took with him Peter and James and John and led them up a high mountain apart by themselves, and he was transfigured before them, and his garments became glistening, intensely white, as no fuller on earth could bleach them. What a little detail, you know. And there appeared to them Elijah with Moses, and they were talking to Jesus. And Peter said to Jesus, Master, it is well that we are here. Let us make three booths, one for you, one for Moses, one for Elijah. For he didn't know what to say. They were exceedingly afraid. And a cloud overshadowed them, and a voice came out of the cloud, This is my beloved Son, listen to him. And suddenly looking around, they no longer saw anyone with them but Jesus only. We're talking here about a vision. This incident is told from the point of view of the disciples. It is something that they experienced. And it is the counterpart for the disciples to Jesus' baptismal experience. In a sense, it is their baptism into the event of Jesus. At Jesus' baptism, we talked about his commissioning. And in that commissioning, he experiences or somehow sees the approval of God on the way in which he sets out to be the Anointed One, the King, the Son of God, the Messiah. He identifies himself with sinners in his baptism, and he will share the fate of the sinner. He will be so closely identified with the sinners that the accusation against him will be, this person receives sinners and eats with them. The hallmark of Jesus' ministry was that he's identified with sinners. It is for this, finally, that he suffers the sinner's fate. When he is executed, it is with this dirty, controversial picture hung in the midst of a couple of obvious criminals. He dies a rebel's death. At his baptism, then, he experiences the vision that says, this is a great thing. This is the way to go. This is the way to be. He experiences, in a sense, God's approval on his messianic pathway. Now the disciples in the Transfiguration have the same kind of experience, you see. We have to supplement this just a little bit with Luke's gospel. If we ask what happened to Jesus in this incident, it is again a confirmation of his vision, his way of being redemptive in the world. What Moses and Elijah are talking to Jesus about is very curiously put in Luke's gospel in the 9th chapter, where he describes the transfiguration vision. They spoke with him about the Exodus, which he was to accomplish in Jerusalem. They spoke with him about the Exodus. You know, notice what's happening here. At the beginning of Israel's own experience as a people, they are literally grabbed by the scruff of their slave necks and yanked out of Egypt, even almost against their will, you know. They didn't want Moses to lead them. And when they got out in the desert, they yearned again for the flesh pots of Egypt. But that was the great redemptive event. That was the way in which God created a people. Once you were not a people, Hosea says to them as God's spokesman, but now you are a people. I have made you a people, literally carved you out of nothing. But notice how the thing changes. In the Exodus, it was the firstborn of the Egyptians who paid the price for the carving out of this people. When the new people of God is created, it will be the only begotten Son of God who pays the price for the creating of the new people. In a sense, it's God leading and deepening Israel to discover that it is not at someone else's expense that they become the people, but that it is at the expense of the Son of God himself and those who are now going to be the sons and daughters of God. A couple of days ago in their session, Chuck and Larry were talking about biblical images and how the image of a new Israel was the one that shaped a lot of the thinking of the people who came to this country. When they crossed the Atlantic, they were really crossing the Jordan. They were coming to the new land, the land of Canaan, the land that God was going to give them. And even though they already found inhabitants here, because they were the new Israel, they could take this land at the expense of the new inhabitants. What that says, in a way, is that we have still not yet learned what God's exodus is really about. For the exodus does not come at someone else's expense. It comes at our expense if we are being let in on Jesus. We stopped in Wyoming at the Custer Battlefield on the way up here this summer. We've always driven by it on our past trips to Holden. Well, this time it was lunchtime, so we decided to drive off the road and just go to the battlefield monument. I think it's really kind of neat that we are today preserving a monument to one of our great defeats, probably the only great defeat that we ever really experienced at the hands of Native Americans. Sobering to go there. Well, at any rate, the Exodus from the point of view of Jesus was that now the monogenes, the only begotten of the Father, is the one who pays the price for being the new people of God. What happens to the disciples? Well, if they were listening to that talk of the Exodus, you see, it's no wonder that they were exceedingly afraid. He didn't know what to say, for they were exceedingly afraid. Because talk of the Exodus now really does say, we are going to be seeing a kind of Messiah that we never thought would be. We are experiencing the bringing together, as I said yesterday, of those two streams out of the Old Testament, the triumphant royal stream of the Messiah and the stream of the crucified or at least suffering and dying servant that it comes to expression in the servant songs of Isaiah. The disciples are let in on, by means of this vision, God's own redemptive purpose. If we want to ask, was the vision a genuine one? There can be no doubt. They really did see this. A lot has been made of the symbols of Moses and Elijah. I don't know whether this means the representatives of the Torah and of the Nevi'im, the two great literary classifications, the Pentateuch and the prophets. Everything that wasn't Pentateuch was prophets in the two literary classifications that the scriptures had. But at any rate, here are the representatives of God's covenant with his people, the one through whom the covenant was given, Moses, and the representative of those voices that were calling Israel to covenant faithfulness, the prophets. And now at the grounding of the new covenant, they are there in a sense to give continuity and also discontinuity to the experience. The same God who covenanted with Israel is still covenanting with his people, but now the covenant will be funneled through the one who will give of himself, who will sacrifice himself on the cross. When the vision ends and they come down from the mountain, the conversation about Elijah continues. And here we have a flat-out textual difficulty. Let me first read it to you, this next four-verse section, and then talk about the textual problem. As they were coming down the mountain, he charged them to tell no one what they had seen until the Son of Man should have risen from the dead. So they kept the matter to themselves, questioning what the rising from the dead meant. And they asked him, "Why do the scribes say that first Elijah must come?" And he said to them, "Elijah does come first to restore all things. And how is it written of the Son of Man that he should suffer many things and be treated with contempt? But I tell you that Elijah has come, and they did to him whatever they pleased, as it is written of him." Now, the problem here, the textual problem, is that a question gets interjected at the point where Jesus is giving an answer. How is it written? It was really very simple for verses to be miscopied in manuscripts when the scrolls were being copied. You didn't have print shops until Gutenberg in the 15th century. And before that, all books were simply hand-copied. So it seems quite evident to almost everybody that a verse here gets out of place. Take the second half of verse 12, the question, and add it after verse 10. Let me read it that way once and see if it doesn't make more sense. So they kept the matter to themselves in verse 10, questioning what the rising from the dead meant, and how is it written of the Son of Man that he should suffer many things and be treated with contempt? And they ask him, why do the scribes say that first Elijah must come? And he said to them, Elijah does come first to restore all things, but I tell you that Elijah has come, and they did to him whatever they pleased, as it is written of him. If we just take that last half of the 12th verse, put it at the end of the 10th, and then we'll see continuity, at least, to Jesus' answer. What is the point? The point is that prophets have never been the most popular of people. When Ralph Gerke last week was doing his Bible studies, he started us off reading Amos with the confrontation between Amos and Amaziah, I think it's Amaziah, the priest. And Amaziah says to Amos, go home, go back to the south, go prophesy down there. Don't come up here and bother us. Elijah gets driven out of the city by Jezebel. Ahab meets him and says, are you the one who is troubling Israel? I thought it was very interesting that in the Missouri Synod conflict, the president of the Missouri Synod referred to the seminary that he finally closed down as the troublers of Israel. So it was quite evident that we knew who was Ahab in that analogy and who the prophets were. You just close down the seminary and get rid of the troublers in Israel. One has to be careful, you know, how you use the Bible. It turns on you, you know, just like that. Well, one of the interesting things that Elijah does, you see, is again to just shatter and explode the understandings of God that were current. In Israel, the national religions and Jezebel's own religion were religions of particular places. You see, God functions it at particular times and in particular places. Elijah does two things. He shatters the notion that the Baals, the local deities, can control the elements. He causes a drought to come, you see. And then he does miracles outside of Israel. He goes to Zarephath in Phoenicia and does miracles there. See, God is not limited to a time, to a place, to a process. That's the essence of the conflict between Yahweh and the Baals, between Elijah and Jezebel. And for it, of course, when the prophet shatters the gods of the people, then he's really going to be in trouble. So, in fact, one of the marks of the prophet, of a prophet for us today, is that he exposes our idolatries, undercuts our cultic deities, breaks and bursts our images. So, the question about Elijah is taken up by Jesus again in the context of breaking the notions, breaking wide open the notions that people have. He says, please.
John the Baptist again, to some extent.
Yes, this is. What Jesus is now doing is saying, Elijah has come. The Baptist has come, and you know what happened to him. I mean, he got a prophet's reward. He lost his head. And they did to him whatever they pleased. If you don't like a prophet, you are going to make very sure that you silence his voice. This is, of course, terribly short-sighted. I thought of this every time in those terrible years we saw the America Love It or Leave It bumper stickers, you know. It was our time to try to get rid of our prophets, of the people who were holding up to us a better vision of ourselves than we were acting out in Southeast Asia. But we didn't want those prophets either, and how short-sighted it all was. It was up here at Holden, I guess about 4 years ago, that I was first introduced to David Halberstam's devastating book, The Best and the Brightest, and read in that book how our own government in Washington systematically built deception and lying into the processes of government. Halberstam tells numerous stories of how the people in Washington quickly learned that Lyndon Johnson was not going to promote anybody in staff or military or government who didn't tell him what he wanted to hear. And there are numerous incidents of commanding officers coming back from Vietnam, telling, you know, with the truth, being scheduled to be on briefing sessions for the president. And when the chiefs of staff discovered what the briefing was really going to be about, they would bump the officer from the briefing sessions so that Johnson did not hear things that Johnson did not want to hear. You know, I sat here and said, but all through those years, I used to say to myself, the president is the best informed man in America. I have since discovered that that is not necessarily true, that everything depends on the character of the president. Reading somewhat later John Tolan's astonishing account of the prelude to World War II, where we broke the Japanese code and were listening to both their military and their diplomatic messages, and then suddenly having to decide which ones were the real ones. Our ambassador from Japan was interpreting the whole Japanese situation one way. The Peace Party was in power, but in order to be in power, they had to give okay to the military to prepare. But the China lobby in the State Department was interpreting the Japanese intentions in another way. They were interpreting them as deceit and duplicity. Roosevelt believed the China lobby, and the result was Pearl Harbor. Strange, you see, to say the president is the best informed. He knows best. We are the ones who don't really know. The Germans used to say, die da oben, you know, the ones up there. They are the ones who know. We're just the little people. But it suddenly began to be clear to me that if you had just been probably a good reader of the New York Times, you might have at your disposal at least everything that the president got, and maybe also be in a better position to make some decisions. Tragic to discover, you see, how short-sighted it is for us not to listen to our prophets, but we are the ones who will always settle for short-run comfort and convenience, as opposed to really living ourselves, living for the long run. That's the kind of thing I think that Larry has been talking about in the way which we in which we make decisions.
Well,
please.
At the end of verse 10, you know, they asked this question. I've got good news here. What does this rising from the death mean? And there seems to be something missing with that in the next question. I don't feel that your transposition of verses there really answers that. What was their thought process about talking about rising from the death and then coming over to Elijah?
No, it's quite simple. Listen, notice how they're questioning. They questioned what the rising from the dead meant.
Yeah.
The Messiah was not to rise from the dead. He wasn't to be killed in the first place.
All right, but now why?
Now, and then it goes on, and how is it written? How is it written of the Son of Man that he should suffer many things and be treated with contempt? The Son of Man vision in the Old Testament was not a vision of defeat, of suffering, of death. It was a vision of glory. The Son of Man was to come in clouds of glory with all his angels with him, you see. So they are sitting here saying, if the Messiah is to die, where is this written? How is this that? What is this, all this talk about the rising from the dead?
The prophets talk about the crucifixion, didn't they realize that they were talking about the same thing?
Yeah, that's the... Let me just repeat once again what I said yesterday. There were two streams of expectation or of vision, which is the best way to talk about it. The vision of the Anointed One, the Messiah, the Son of God, was a vision of triumph, of the throne of David enduring forever, you see, and of the nation... being great among the nations. And that was what the messianic hope was about. Then there was the vision of the suffering servant that came out of the exile and that gets this powerful expression in the second half of Isaiah. These two streams were not joined in the tradition until Jesus joins them. That is the new thing that he is doing, you see. And that was what just blew everybody's mind. They had not heard this before. It seemed inconceivable to them, not only because it had not been joined before, but because it isn't what they wanted. Let me, I brought something along. I just want to share this with you now. This is from Robert Farrar Capon's little book, Hunting the Divine Fox, in which he talks about our messiahs. I will find it in a minute. He says, the true paradigm of the ordinary American view of Jesus is Superman. Faster than a speeding bullet, more powerful than a locomotive, able to leap tall buildings in a single bound, it's Superman, strange visitor from another planet, who came to Earth with powers and abilities far beyond those of mortal men, and who, disguised as Clark Kent, mild-mannered reporter for a great metropolitan newspaper, fights a never-ending battle for truth, justice, and the American way. If that isn't popular Christology, I'll eat my hat, he goes on. Jesus, gentle, meek, and mild, but with secrets souped up more than human insides, bumbles around for 33 years, nearly gets himself done in for good by the kryptonite cross, but at the last minute struggles into the phone booth of the empty tomb, changes into his Easter suit, and with a single bound leaps back to the planet heaven. You think that's funny, he goes on. Don't laugh. The human race is, was, and probably always will be deeply unwilling to accept Jesus as the Messiah. We don't want to be saved in our humanity. We want to be fished out of it. We crucified Jesus not because he was God, but because he blasphemed. He claimed to be God's Messiah and failed to come up to our standards for assessing the claim. It's not that we weren't looking for Messiah. It's just that he wasn't what we were looking for. Our kind of Messiah would come down from the cross. He would carry the folding phone booth in his back pocket. He wouldn't do a stupid thing like rising from the dead. He would do a smart thing like not dying in the first place. And if you don't believe me, look at the whole tradition of Messiah figures in our culture. Superman is a classic, but there are others just as good. Look at all the sheriffs in the typical salvation western. Matt Dillon can be wounded but not killed, daunted but never defeated. He looks like a man, but he's really the avenging angel in drag. And just to prove it, the same old device is trotted out. You know Miss Kitty's business. I know Miss Kitty's business. It's a safe bet Miss Kitty knows her business, but Matt might as well be a Martian for all the good it does him. The only belt he gets out of her comes in a little beer glass with a lot of talk. Ditto the Lone Ranger, hi-hoing around the days of yesteryear, with Tonto, a white horse, and a belt full of silver bullets. Everybody else is human, Doc, Festus, Quint, Kitty, the drovers, the sodbusters, the townsfolk, the bad guys, but the Messiah who saves them all is unbendingly, unflinchingly divine in the sense of not having to suffer. And then he goes on to the clincher. I'm still reading TV Guide, he said, only this time it's Lassie. Little Timmy goes schlepping all over the countryside, getting himself lost, strayed, or stolen, but he's practically the only human character in the show. Mother and father are a couple of clowns who couldn't keep track of the movements of Mount Rushmore. And poor Jack Ging having to play the chaplain. Turn off the set. I can't stand to watch a grown man make a fool of himself. But no matter, Lassie conquers all. She will be beaten by bad men, bitten by alligators, clawed by mountain lions, left for dead in the desert. But 3 days later, home she comes, with the snow goose on her back, the ailing poodle in an improvised litter, and in her mouth, mother's wedding ring, father's wallet, and a note to pick up Timmy at the supermarket. Hunting the Divine Fox by Robert Farrar Capon. He's a marvelous theologian. We've got some books of his back there. he says he has a sure refutation for epistemological skeptics, that is, people who think we can't really know anything for certain. He just leans over to one and whispers, "Your fly is open." They always look, he says, and they're refuted right on the spot. Well, marvelous theologian. Anyway, so the point is, you see, that they could no more understand this within the framework of Israel's vision than we really are ready to live with this. Our messiahs do not rise from the dead because they do not die in the first place. You see, Kojak is there every week.
The emphasis in early Christianity on Son of God and Son of Man.
pulling the two streams together, right, in that one place?
It's more complicated than that. The Son of Man, the triumphant Son of Man, is really the crucified one. See, the Son of Man was not a statement about his humanity. It was really a statement about his coming on the clouds with great power and glory and all his angels. That was the Son of Man that Daniel talked about. So when they said, you know, when Jesus used that title of himself, it was almost a joke that the Son of Man who comes with power and glory and all his angels is there on the cross. You see, you will see the Son of Man, he says to the chief priests at his trial, and they hustle him off to the cross for blasphemy. Now, either, you see, he was wrong, or the Son of Man is the crucified one. That's the contradiction. Dick, go ahead.
Generalization that fits Johnson and ever so many characters in this thing here, and it goes like this: never underestimate the ability of people to remain ignorant in the presence of all the information.
Yes, but the amazing thing is, it happens to all of us. I mean, you're right, and that's
okay,
what you're saying.
It's everybody in this place.
Yeah, I don't want to single out Johnson or indeed anybody else. We elect people like us, you know, that's what's really astonishing. And the more like us they are, the more likely they are to be elected, you see. And so here we sit, indicting them and ourselves in the same process. All right, let me go on. Just a couple more things. We have until 9:30 this morning. And Chuck, John says you got to ring the bell to start your own session. So
we're going by this clock, which still says 8:27.
No. We got about 12 more minutes, and then go bong the bell. All right. Now comes this incident with the epileptic boy. Here is an epileptic with suicidal mania, and the disciples try to cast out the demon, and they don't make it. So Jesus, I'm starting about verse 21. Jesus asks the father, how long has he had this? And he said, from childhood, and it has often cast him into the fire and into the water to destroy him. But if you can do anything, have pity on us and help us. And Jesus said to him, if you can, he's giving his own words back, all things are possible to him who believes. One of the interesting helps that I've had with this is C.S. Lewis's marvelous analysis of just this statement, and similar statements, with God all things are possible. Lewis says the thing to emphasize here is things. All things are possible. He's not saying non-things, absurd things are possible, as if we could just invent all kinds of conundrums. Can God make a stone so big he can't move it, you see? As if there we have demonstrated that all things are not possible. Mm-hmm. Lewis would say the emphasis is on things. Now, what thing is possible here for one who believes? Why, healing is possible, you see. We have all experienced the possibilities of healing, so it is one of the things that is possible. The father's reply to what amounts to a rebuke is really a statement, I believe, help my unbelief. That is, if I need more faith, please see to it that I have it. And then Jesus rebukes the unclean spirit, you deaf and dumb spirit, I command you come out of him and never enter him again. And after crying and convulsing him terribly, it came out, and the boy was like a corpse, so that most of them said he is dead. But Jesus took him by the hand and lifted him up, and he arose. And when he had entered the house, the disciples asked him privately, why couldn't we cast it out? And he said to him, this kind cannot be driven out by anything but prayer. We begin to experience here again something of what prayer is. It is not latching on to the cosmic slot machine and hitting the jackpot. Prayer really involves the struggle with God against evil, so that if we are really praying in the name of Jesus, it means we are being plunged by God into his own struggle against evil at whatever cost to ourselves in the process. For the final model for prayer, the reason why Jesus has power over the demons is because he goes to the cross. To pray for the hungry of the world really says, yeah, we're going to be involved. At what cost? Well, at cost to us. So all things are possible to those who believe. That is, to those who range themselves on the side of God's way of being redemptive in the world. You see, you can be a part of the redemptive people of God if you want to be. There isn't even a very long line. you can get right in there, you know. You could be seized almost at once. The waiting list is pretty short for suffering servants, for taking up the cross. But you see, if we really want this, if we trust Jesus so that we want to be in on what he is up to in the world, we'll get the chance. All things are possible, you see. You can really engage yourself in the needs of the world, in God's struggle against evil, if you want to. The cost is to be the crucified one. Then he tells them, they went on from there and passed through Galilee, and he would not have anyone know it, for he was teaching his disciples. See, this is the time to confront them, saying to them, the Son of Man will be delivered into the hands of men, and they will kill him. And when he is killed, after 3 days he will rise. But they did not understand the saying, and they were afraid to ask him. The last time Peter had asked him, he'd been called Satan. And they came to Capernaum. And when he was in the house, he asked them, what were you discussing on the way? But they were silent. For on the way they had discussed with one another who was the greatest. This is how they did not understand, you see. And he sat down, as a teacher did, and called the 12 and said to them, if anyone would be first, he must be last of all and servant of all. And he took a child and put him in the midst of them, and taking him in his arms, he said to them, whoever receives one such child in my name receives me. And whoever receives me receives not me, but him who sent me. What I just want to say a concluding word here about this use of the child. Jesus does not idealize children. And the point is not to say, you thought you were great, and you were arguing who is going to be great, but it's really the children who are great. That isn't the point at all. In fact, it's always what we do is we look at little kids who are maybe sound asleep, and they look so cute, and we say, my, isn't it, you know, the kingdom of God is really being like a child. But I think all we have to do is watch the kinds of things children can do to each other to see that that isn't the case. They can be incredibly cruel. They can do terrible things to each other. We of course, as adults, do the same thing. I'm only trying to say they're not much better than us. Rather, what Jesus is trying to say is something about greatness as a quest. He is saying that very quest is mistaken, for what you really should be questing is the servant role. There is nothing very particularly spectacular, very great in caring for children. Think of how, you know, when you ask a woman especially, what do? She says, I'm only a housewife. You know, I don't do anything really important. And we all agree, more or less, or we did at least, before our consciousness was raised. Nothing great about doing that. I thought about that when Jana had matins this morning, you know. We do not say to her, Professor Jana, because she works with these handicapped, severely handicapped children. But somebody who teaches her, you see, is the great expert and the power in the world. So there's nothing, you know, if you're only a first grade teacher, you see, or even worse, only a teacher of the severely handicapped, you're not regarded as anything very great. And I think the interesting thing is that Jesus is trying to say the whole quest for greatness is the wrong one. The quest is to be redemptive. And it may very well be that first grade teachers and teachers of the severely handicapped are the redemptive people in our society. Well, I'm ready for us to sort of stretch so we can get ready for a 9:30 session.